Good afternoon. I'm Susan McGinnis, your host for Sunday at Noon on KUAC FM. Well, the legislative session has just adjourned a couple of days ago. Coming up before us, perhaps in the summer, a special session. A little later, a pivotal issue in the life of party politics. This is election year. Offices of U.S. Senator, U.S. House of Representatives, the Governor, Lieutenant Governor, and several state, Senate, and House of Representatives seats will be open, and the parties are off. For the next 2 weeks, on this Sunday at Sunday at Noon and next Sunday on Sunday at Noon, I'd like to bring to you the thoughts of Republicans and of Democrats on those issues. This week, we're going to be talking with three Republicans active in the Republican Party for many years. Next week, a panel of Democrats. We hope you'll stay with us on Sunday at Noon for Party Politics in Alaska. Today with us is Bert Sharp. He is currently a representative to the state legislature for House Seat 20A. He is running for election. No one has filed against him yet. He served for 3 years in the early 60s as the treasurer for the Central District, which was then the title for Districts 18, 19, and 21 collectively. He spent many years thereafter as an independent and then returned to the fold of the Republican Party. He sits with us today to talk about party politics in Alaska. Also with us, Nancy Mendenhall. She is a longtime active Republican, past president of the Fairbanks Republican Women's Club, also past state treasurer for the Alaska Republican Women's Club, coordinator for the past 4 and 5 years for the regular Republican luncheons here in Fairbanks, active in campaigns for many years on her own. She ran for the school board and served that body for 12 years. With us also, Chuck Lowry. He was chair for District 20 for 2 terms. He has been an active precinct committee man and is known around town and around the state as a Republican activist. Chuck, Bert, and Nancy, thank you very much for joining me today. Welcome to Sunday at Noon. I want to start with the session because it has just ended and may still be uppermost in people's minds. It was called the most productive session since 1976. More bills passed, more issues got settled than any other. And, on the other hand, it was called one of the least productive legislative sessions in the history of the state of Alaska. Major things did not get settled. Ethics went down in the last minutes of the session. The subsistence issue went down. The governor's educational endowment went down. A great many things on which have been the subject of discussion for a great many months just disappeared in the last hours of the session. Bert Sharp, since you were there, perhaps you can take a look at the session real briefly for us and where you think it was productive and where you think it perhaps failed the voters, if that's not too strong a thought.
I'd be glad to do that. My impressions are going to be on the House of Representatives,
sure,
which took all of my time. I would attribute much of the problems of not getting some key legislation passed in the waning hours of the session primarily due to the fact that the priority bills were not identified any time during the session, even up to the last several days, by the leadership of the House. I would say that if that had been done and the scheduling done properly, and identified the bills that were priority for the leadership of the House, that could have happened. The makeup of the House, as you know, is 24-16. Plenty of votes there to pass any legislation that had to be passed. But it got jammed up in committee because the committee chairman were not organized and attuned to what was the priorities of the majority, House majority.
And do you think, well, I was going to ask you, and do you think of the people? Were there priorities of the people as you saw them as a representative?
Yes, there was, I believe there were certain mandates that the public sent us down there to accomplish the last couple of years. One of them, being a high priority, was reducing the budget in some way, stopping the growth of state employees as a part of that process. Neither one of those things happened, unfortunately.
We had more money this year and spent more money this year.
The typical political process was that the forecast came out rosy about the 1st of April, and the spending goals increased parallel with that rosy forecast. So unfortunately, now the price of oil is back down again after the die is set on the spending. We'll see how we come out at the end of the fiscal year, of the 91 fiscal year. But that was one of the primary charges, I believe, that at least the constituents in my area voiced during the election and during the 2 years that I was down there. And another issue was to somehow set some priorities of state policies for reasonable resource development. The state still has not set what is the state policy for mineral development, timber development, oil development. It's still a haphazard situation that's governed by the pressures of any given time and governor.
Mm-hmm. And it may be an issue in the upcoming campaign, and nothing may be settled during that campaign.
True.
Yeah. Nancy Mendenhall, I wonder if you have thoughts as someone in Fairbanks watching a session move forward and then close. And Chuck, then the same question, I think, to you.
Well, there were certain issues I was certainly interested in. One was subsistence, and my feeling was that the outcome of that in this legislature was very much as I'd hoped it would be. I was glad to see the education fund not go forward. I had several little smaller things that I was very interested in. One was a bill which Bert Sharp introduced, which would make available to any citizen the total voting record of legislators. Right now, there is no way that any one of us voters can go down to the legislative office and find the voting record of any legislator. A legislator can get his own voting record, his or her own voting record, but we are not privy to that information. Obviously, it must be on the computer, and Bert did introduce a bill to make that available and was successful in having that bill finally attached to another bill, which did pass. So all of us should be better off in knowing what our individual legislators are doing down there.
Bert, I want to go back to you for just a second. If one is coming from a distrustful perspective, one would say, well, for all these years, they haven't wanted us to know how they're voting. On the other hand, one might say that it was an oversight not to computerize and list and make available. What has been the situation, and how is it rectified by your bill?
Well, when I first arrived in Juneau several years ago, about 2 months into the session, one of my constituents wanted to know how I had voted on up to that time. I called the House clerk, asked for a copy of my actual voting record by each consecutive day on every bill that was on the calendar for those days, said that it was available, but I had to come over and personally sign for it. Only the legislator could get his or her record, which I thought very strange. I mean, it was on the computer. It was available. It seemed terribly shielded from the constituents not to make it available through the LIO offices or anything else, and that was why, at that time, I decided to introduce legislation that would make it available. It took less than 2 hours for me to get it. My total voting record for the whole session at the end of that first year. So it is there and really easily available. Nancy's right. We did get that attached to House Bill 405, which was more or less to open the information access to all agencies, and it went through over to the Senate and came back and passed in the last 2 hours with that paragraph still in there. So I'm glad to see that happen.
We're talking today with representatives from the Grand Old Party. We have today. We're focusing on Republican issues and questions. You've been listening just now to the voice of Bert Sharpe, who is a representative to the House of Representatives from District 20A. Nancy Mendenhall is also here with us, and Chuck Lowry. Chuck, I want to turn that initial question to you. What's your sense of the session? Did you look on it with favor, or is your sense that the legislators didn't do so well?
Didn't do so well. Disfavor, of course. Being an old Republican activist, that's the old in GOP, incidentally. I think Bert hit the nail on the head when he said they didn't have direction in the House because they certainly had the votes to do so. But this being an election year, legislators without any concern other than getting reelected, they're all going to be sure that they don't do anything that antagonizes their constituency. But I think the other half of it is the Senate, and I paid more attention to that probably because of the business of coalition politics again, and we had our illustrious leader, Coalition Kelly, out there making his deals, and many people said that it was a Republican-led legislature. I know the news might have referred to that consistently, and yet it wasn't a Republican-led Senate. It was a Republican president of the Senate, and most of the committees were chaired by Democrats. And any time that you have coalition politics in that manner, and as Bert says, no leadership in the House, what you have simply is, despite what they say about productivity, you have a lack of quality. And I'd rather see less productivity, put that word in quotes, mm-hmm. and a heck of a lot more quality. And I don't think we had it this year.
You mentioned earlier, Bert Sharpe, the leadership not being able to find the priorities or decide where they are. That's one thing that's in my mind from what you just had to say, Chuck. And the other thing is a question of it's closer to a question of ethics, so I guess that's where I'm wanting to move right now. It is possible for a committee chair to not let bills be discussed, not bring them to committee. It's possible for the leadership to keep things from getting to the floor, and this refers to your thought about quality, Chuck. It's possible to hold issues back until the very last days of the session. Whether or not this happened on purpose this session or not is almost irrelevant to this discussion. So that at the end, like this session, there's just a scramble, and not much, as Chuck says, of quality is done. My question, and I'll just open it to the table, is such manipulating and holding hostage going to be changed by ethics legislation? Is it going to be changed by the way we elect our representatives? Or is it going to be changed at all? I look at you, Bert, but I open it to the table.
Well, I commend Bert for his getting this bill passed where you can get the legislators' voting record, because that's the first thing in establishing ethics, because if you can't tell what the legislator voted on, you can't approach him and say, you can't even open a dialogue with him because you have no grounds or no basis for doing so. And I think the very fact that Bert got something like this through is speaks to his ability as a legislator. Now, that's what I call quality. At least you may disagree with some of the things or the votes that Bert had, but at least the record is up there for you to open a dialogue with him. And those who stand behind the inability of the public to get their voting records, this is part of what makes people look upon politicians as slightly above used car salesmen.
Okay, so that's a start. What about last year in the frustration over the ELF legislation, the economic limit factor? Tim Kelly attached a bill regarding marijuana to it, stopped it cold. Democrats wouldn't vote for it. Republicans wouldn't vote for it. The economic limit factor, which is a fairly important piece of legislation, sat there. I mean, eventually something got passed, but it sat there. What about, again, I'm asking questions about holding thing hostage, about attaching riders, about manipulations within the House where things don't come before the floor? Bert Sharpe?
I'll make a few comments on that. The committee chairman definitely can abuse the power to the extent they can stop key legislation. Even the governor's bills were killed mm-hmm. in the House in our resource committee, for instance. The governor and his people were pushing hard for instance, a reaffirmation of the Camden Bay lease sale so that could proceed without possibility of legal suit against the state. One co-chairman of resources, Mr. Davidson from Kodiak, was successful in holding that bill in committee until the final day, until he released it. It was impossible to get it passed in the House and the Senate to concur. There's other instances that were bills that were mandated by Supreme Court action and was spent 2 years of testimony by public input to craft these bills, died because of being held hostage. The game outfitters and game guide bill, for instance, was one that died. Something's got to be done about it.
But what is my question?
The stopgap methods, my understanding is that the Board of Fish and Game will have to implement emergency regulations as an interim situation until the legislature can address the problem next year.
But I'm asking more about the general than the specific. Nancy Mendenhall, your thoughts?
Well, I don't know that we can stop a committee chairman from holding a bill back. But I think that there could be, and Bert could comment on this further, there should be a way of preventing this piggyback where one, you mentioned the marijuana bill being piggybacked onto something else. It seems to me when you have two issues that are completely different that we should not have those two issues come up in the same bill. If they're similar, why, that's fine. But two completely different issues should not be piggybacked one upon the other.
Especially one's being used to hold the other one back, because
yes,
neither will be voted for. What is your thought about the ethics legislation? Should there be, Chuck Lowry, an ethics package put through a legislature?
I don't think you can change the basic philosophy of a legislator who goes down there. You know, ethics, I heard, I heard Jack Coghill say that ethics is learned at your mother's table. And I believe that. You go down there with a set of principles. I don't think any ethics legislation is going to go anywhere or be of any value to us as long as we have the type of campaign spending that we have now and as long as we still have the coalition politics and the quid pro quid. You know, I'll vote for this if you vote for that. Until the day comes when clearly one party or the other has the Senate or the House and appoints their committee chairman. And so at that point you say not only is individual chairmen responsible, but so are the members of the party. And if the rascals don't vote in a proper manner, now recognizing that we don't agree with everything 100% on anything, but what you have to do is say, did this legislator come within 75 or 80% of the things that I hold valuable to me and to the state and to our concerns? And the other 20% may be miscellaneous. But on that basis, I'm going to keep this legislator in office and this party in office and hold them accountable. And when they no longer are accountable to me and I disagree with the things they're doing, it's to the detriment of the state and the constituents, vote the rascals out. But the way we are here in Alaska, I don't think we'll ever come to the point we'll have sufficient ethics legislation because there's no reason for them to have to do so. They can't be held accountable.
So there's no pressure.
There's no pressure.
Yeah.
And all the, you know, it's a good campaign issue to talk about ethics. And look at one of the guys that was talking about him, Coalition Kelly himself. And what was he doing? Making all sorts of deals here.
So it looks good to the voters. Voters will have a memory of that, but voters may not have the long-term memory of the lapses in terms of ethical behavior.
Well, yes, and I think that's part of the reason for apathy, because people say, what good does it do? Now, you may disagree with somebody. I could disagree with Representative Sharp, but if I'm under the impression that he's an honest man and he is a responsible man and he has my best interest, we can have a legitimate disagreement and I'll still vote for him.
Nancy, did you have a thought about this?
Well, I don't think ethics really makes a dishonest or a person without integrity have integrity or be honest. A person who doesn't have integrity is just going to get around it. I know years ago when I was on the school board, we came up with an ethics bill, or the other members did. I voted against it because in there it said things like we must not attack each other and we must do this and we must do that. And I felt my loyalty was not to the other members of the board. It was to the voters and to the citizens in the community, and that I really didn't owe anything, or that I should keep still when I felt something was going on that I felt was wrong. I voted against it. I think I was the only one to vote against it. I don't think ethics bills make people more ethical, or that they make them have any more integrity.
Birchot, your thoughts?
The ethics bill that was before us late in the session, the House got it the last week. It was 94 pages, the first House draft I seen, and went through it very, very carefully. My big problem with it, bottom line, is that it addressed two situations. One was a pay raise, doubling of the pay for the legislators. The other was ethics. They should not have been in there together. They should have split out. In fact, on the House floor, the day the bill was killed, we again tried to split it out. It failed. Then the whole bill failed. We want to split out and vote on the pay raise separately, vote on ethics separately, and that's the way it should have been. And as far as I'm concerned, any bill that has a doubling the pay plus the other perks that was in there is unethical in itself. So,
classic example of ethics, huh? I'll vote for an ethics bill if you give me a pay raise.
An unethical ethics bill.
Yes.
Another thing that went down was the governor's education endowment. Nancy Mendenhall, you began your thoughts at the beginning of the session, included that pleased you. You didn't think that should be.
Well, I, you know, years ago, before we became a very rich state, before the oil pipeline and so on, the people in Alaska really didn't have a lot of money. Most of us lived in small houses. We lived from paycheck to paycheck. It was not easy living. But we did have a good educational system in this state. In this community, according to the Iowa Basic Skills Test, our test scores for the Fairbanks area as a whole were running above the 90th percentile. People cared about education, and they were willing to vote money to support it. I think it shows a lack of faith in people to suppose that we have to set up a fund because people are not going to vote for enough money to support education. I'm not sure that just increasing money to education means that we have better education. I think it does up to a point. After that point, I think the quality of education actually declines because you have so many programs going on and there is so much happening that there is not a clear direction that a school district takes. So I was very happy to see that education fund bill that was to put it on the ballot fail.
We're taking a look today at the Republican perspective, and that was one on the educational endowment. Chuck Lowry, do you agree with Nancy Mendenhall's perspective there?
Well, yes, I do. The endowment fund, I think, was two things. Number one, just a roundabout way or a backdoor entry into tapping a permanent fund. Once you ever tap that fund, the door is open and it'll be like a rail belt fund, which was set aside, as most of you know, to help the rail belt come up with energy cost efficiency and to help offset the subsidization that you get out in the rural areas. The second part of that endowment fund is once you did that, you know, if you look at the states that have instituted lotteries, and the lotteries were to benefit education. Now, theoretically, the lotteries were to supplement what the General Assembly or their legislature was already spending on education. But in reality, what has happened is that the lottery was then, the more money the lottery took in, the more the assemblies or the legislatures cut back on the money coming out of the general fund to support education. So they really didn't gain. And I suspect that Alaska is not so much different. Our legislature would then say, you've got $40 million. Oh, it may not happen in 1 year or 2 years or 5 years. But down the road, they would say, well, things are a little tight. You already got $40 million in this endowment fund. We can take that $40 million and put it someplace else. But the worst part, I think, is you just give the education establishment more money to waste out there. And I was reading an article in the Anchorage Daily News, and this was a couple of weeks ago before I knew I was going to be on this. I wish I had kept it now. But it talked about the percentage of monies going into the curriculum, the actual instruction in schools. And they were down in the 50 to 52 to 55%. I think the highest school district was 62. I think we'd be far better off if the legislature defined something like what basic education is, and all of that's going to go and be funded 100% by the state. And then if you want to add all of the defined basic education as what happens out in the buildings, and then locally raise your money to support your administrative staff and the other things you want, and I'll bet we'd see a big change in this. But the endowment fund, to me, was an irresponsible piece of legislation.
Now, the state of Texas would disagree. When they had plenty of pipeline money, they took created an endowment, and now that they're having difficult times, they're thanking their stars. I turn to you, Bert Sharp, with that thought.
As Chuck previously mentioned, this is where we have our disagreements. This is one area. Last year, I voted for the constitutional amendment endowment, education endowment, and it moved out of the House fairly easily, I think 30-some votes. The situation is, and why I voted for it, is I'm not necessarily saying I philosophically agree with that technique of funding education. I don't believe in dedicated funds. It takes the burden and the responsibility off the back of the elected politician. They can shrug their shoulders later and say, hey, I got no control over that, and the electorate cannot hold them accountable. But the reason I voted for it is the fact that, in my mind, the people are the stewards of the permanent fund, and they should have a right to make the decision on the use of those earnings. And that's what would happen if it would have got on the ballot. The only other problem is that happened after the House voted on it is the governor came out and spent many hundreds of thousands of dollars in state funds for propaganda to get the Senate to vote for it. And I'm afraid that would have turned into an avalanche once it was destined for the ballot and would have been financed with state funds to see that it passed the electorate. That's my problem. And once it gets to that stage, it just takes a simple majority mm-hmm. of the electorate, not two-thirds like it does to get out of the House and the Senate. So the slowdown process and the deliberation process is definitely in the legislature where it takes two-thirds. But I still feel that the people are the stewards of the fund and should have a shot at it.
I want to turn quickly to the area of subsistence. Any action by this legislature went down, was cut off in the last moments. At this point, it opens the door to a July 1 entry by the federal government to manage 60% of Alaska's lands. I'm interested in the Republican perspective on that entry, no matter how you feel about the question of who should have subsistence rights in this state. How do you feel about the federal government coming in, open to the table?
I would Bert just start it off by saying that I was definitely against the constitutional amendment approach. I still am. That amendment would have basically stated that would have given any legislature the authority to allocate renewable natural resources, fish and game, and other renewable resources, as a matter of fact, to specific geographic areas or population elements of the state. It is not a subsistence issue. It is a equality and fairness issue. Subsistence can be taken care of or personal use through legislative action without channeling it to special groups. It has been in the past been accommodated through methods and means and seasons and was very effective up until about 15 years ago until we got entangled in pipeline right-of-ways and offsetting that with the NILCA and bartering away some of these chips. And we're still suffering for it. But the fact is this vote on the constitutional amendment, the way it was worded, was not a subsistence issue. It would have allowed further federal legislation coming down the pike in the future, which could be more regressive, would have given future legislators even the opportunity to further change Alaska statutes to conform with future federal legislation.
So you
big
don't,
problem.
So you don't put up a bad bill, or you don't create bad law just because of the threat of an outside influence.
That's right. I believe that would be a temporary fix, and future generations would suffer greatly for it.
Okay. I don't want to solve the subsistence problem in the next 40 minutes while we sit here, but are there any additional questions, comments on the federal takeover and or the direction of the state legislature or lack thereof? Nancy?
Well, I did a little review of some of this, and in 1978, the legislature passed a subsistence bill, which said that people had subsistence use over other uses, but it wasn't rural. And that's the addition of the word rural, which was put into a federal law in 1980. It was added to the subsistence bill that Congress had passed, and it was done at the insistence of the Alaska Federation of Natives. So the problem is the word rural. And then in 1986, we had the state pass the law putting in rural. And last fall, the Supreme Court declared that it was unconstitutional because our Constitution says that all the resources of Alaska are available for everyone. We don't make them available just for certain people. So I think the thing that this constitutional amendment, the governor wanted that it would cut out the guarantee of common use and equal opportunity and use the word rural for just certain people of the state. It would provide for a subsistence use based upon rural residency is what it would do. And I think that that would supposedly help preserve the culture and so on. But really, laws don't preserve culture. People preserve culture. And I think it's essential that this state stand up. And we came in under the Statehood Act, which was accepted by the Constitution was accepted by the federal government at that time. No other state has been under this sort of situation. And I think we should amend that ANILCA and remove the word rural. And I think that would take care of it. I think we need a lawsuit.
Okay. That's the voice of Nancy Mendenhall. She is past officer for the Fairbanks Republican Women's Club and the state of Alaska Republican Women's Club. Sorry, I'm botching that badly. She currently coordinates and has for the past 5 years the Republican luncheons in the town of Fairbanks and has been active in the Republican Party for a number of years. Also with us today, Chuck Lowry. He was the chair for District 20 Republican Party for 2 terms. He has been a precinct committee man as well and is a Republican activist in Fairbanks. Bert Sharp is currently a representative serving District 20A. He is up for re-election. He is uncontested at this point. Has served the Central District as an officer some many years ago, left the Republican Party, and has returned in the last several years to the fold, as they say. The focus of our conversation today on Sunday at noon is Republican Party politics. Next week, we're going to take a look at the Democrats. So if you like your sides carefully balanced, just wait a week. Within 7 days, we'll give you a balanced sandwich of political views. I want to take a look now at a global issue in our state. I don't know what the numbers are, but I know that we have more registered independents than of either party. Democrats do not predominate in this state. Republicans do not predominate in this state. People run for the Republican or the Democratic Party nomination, but independents largely elect people. How does that feel to be a Republican and a staunch activist Republican in the state of Alaska when mostly independents are the people who will elect? Nancy, I want to give Chuck a chance to respond first, since you had the last word on the last subject, and because he's sitting here with gleaming eyes.
Well, I'm very opinionated on that subject, as you might well understand. I believe that we should have closed primaries. Now, I think that people need to... I recognize a lot of the reasons that we have a lot of independents is because they work for the government and they don't want to really reveal where they stand
on those
issues.
Oh, do you think so?
But when they go to the ballot box, why, they make that choice clear. But I think a part of the reason that we cannot have any consistent approach in the legislature by parties and any accountability is simply because of this independent system. In a closed primary, you have to declare as a Republican or a Democrat and then vote for whoever is on the ballot. Now, in the general election, you vote for whomever you want, and you also it's open to independents, nonpartisans, or whatever other term they want to put for themselves. But at the present time, you cannot have any discipline because I remember when Rick Rieckhoff ran for governor. You may recall that a few years back. Rick came down from Wiseman, and he went to run for governor. And they told him, well, what party was he? And he said, at the flick of a wrist and a little signature, I became a Republican. Well, obviously, you can also do a lot of damage to a party if you want to do so. In fact, I thought for a little while, everybody knows I'm a Republican, but I thought, why shouldn't I file against Mark Boyer just for the sheer sake of creating a little problems for Mark Boyer? But philosophically, I could not bring myself to do that because I am a Republican. Independence, I recognize that may hurt your feelings, but I think you ought to get off the fence and declare yourself one way or another and get in there and work with that party and make that party whatever you happen to believe. That's how we fight our principles out.
Just a little background for people who may not know. Prior to 1967, we did have a closed system.
Oh, is that
right?
You
were a Republican or you were a Democrat or you weren't. Mm-hmm. After 1967, it opened up, and I can, if I want to, vote for one person in one race who's a Republican and one who's a Democrat in another race, and no one knows the difference. In other states, you'll get a ballot that's a Republican ballot or a Democrat ballot.
Right.
Okay. Who has other thoughts on this issue? And why should we have stronger parties in the state of Alaska?
Well, Nancy, let me just point out about this primary. We had a modified closed primary before, and you did not have to be either a Republican or a Democrat. You could be a Republican and get the Democrat and just vote the Democrat side.
Right. Yeah.
So you didn't. There are several ways of doing it, and that seemed to me to be a very good way to do it. But I'd just like to point out, with all these independents around, really, it's just an open field. We ought to, as Republicans, go out there and recruit and get these people into the party where they can help determine the direction of government. You cannot assign responsibility to 60 little kings down there, 40 in the House and 20 in the Senate. We really need parties to set the general direction of where government ought to go. Then, if people are unhappy with the way that government is going, they can say, well, there are the Democrats or there are the Republicans. Next time, we're going to change the party we vote for.
Bert Sharpe, do you have a thought? Does it matter to you?
None other than the fact that just looking at the last general election 2 years ago in the House of Representatives, if you added up the total votes of the people that voted for 16 successful Republicans and 24 successful Democrats, you would find that 55% of the total voters voted for the 16 Republicans. But still, there was only They missed control of the House by 8. There was that difference. So it's that swing is very meaningful of that independent swing.
And that means to you what? That most of the independents who are voting are of a conservative bent, but simply are not aligned. Is that?
That's my impression, that they lean more to the conservative side than the other side, and the other thing that reveals is that redistricting next year is going to make a whale of a difference of who's elected and so forth, because you've got some districts where there's 10-to-1 difference, where a House district person will get 10,000 votes and in another rural district running unopposed, they'll get 1,900 votes. And you go down there and you push the same button and you're representing 10 times more people.
Well, you know, interject just a little bit here. What happens is you have independents who may, in fact, be independents, or they may be Democrats electing Republican candidates in the same manner as what you may well have that same situation for the Democratic Party. But what concerns me the most there is the ability of Democrats to move over in sufficient numbers to affect a race in a primary for the Republicans, as the Republicans can do for the Democrats, too. For example, if the Democrat who happens to be opposing Burt we don't know how this is going to shake out yet, but just assume the Democrat is going to be opposing Burt and he has no opposition and somebody files against Burt, the Democrat has a walk. He's going to be in there. He's going to be the nominee. So all of the other available Democrats would go over and vote for the one that, you know, that they thought would be the easiest for them to defeat. Now, to me, this goes down to the business of ethics again. And how do you get people down the legislature who will stand for some principle when they're willing to do this sort of thing? I guess all's fair in love, war, and politics, but I don't buy that.
Democrat Pat Clark, who's very active in this town,
right,
argued similarly that the weaker candidate can end up the nominee, can end up the final candidate. But my question to both of you would be, and if I get a chance to talk to Pat next week, will be, do you think this state, in this state, that sort of manipulation does indeed happen at the polling place? I recognize the validity of your charge. I want to know if you think it really has happened and does happen.
Yes, I do.
And do you think the Democrats or the Republicans are most guilty?
Well, that I really couldn't say, because I don't know of any way you could quantify that to give an accurate answer.
I want to know, does it happen on both sides from your perspective?
Well, I think it happens on both sides, absolutely. In fact, I know it happens on both sides.
The question I have in my mind now shifts off of voting strictly by party, but it has a good deal to do with voting strictly by party, and that's the question of single-issue politics. We have seen from the most conservative side, and I'm not speaking politically here, a move to defeat candidates, let us say, who are pro-choice, or from the other side, move in other states mostly, to defeat candidates who are pro-life. Do you think that single-issue politics, let's say if it were to happen in the state of Alaska over ANWR, for example, an issue that will come upon us in the next few years, or if it were to happen over subsistence, less likely but possible, what do you think that would do to the parties and to the candidates? And do you think single-party politics is a fair way to approach the issue of politics in general? Anybody? Bert?
I feel in Alaska it's not as important or a decisive factor as it is in the lower 48. Here in Alaska, there's no excuse for the individual voter not to know the candidates that's running for office. Personally, walk up, talk to them. The districts are small enough. There's the candidates are available in all kinds of forums, state fairs, all meetings, luncheons. It goes on continuously, as I found out the hard way. And you're always available, and anyone and everyone has a chance to walk up to you, talk about their particular concerns, and expect to get an answer back before he casts his ballot. And I think that is the charge that the voter has to accept, and they do. And therefore, the single issues, which are very important to the individual voters, still come down to the fact when the voter looks at the two candidates, they look at the alternative on each side, too. You know, if I don't vote for A, do I really want to vote for B? You know, so it shakes out, and the single issue finally fades a little bit when they compare the two candidates and the total candidates, because they have that ability to examine them a lot closer and a lot more personally here than in the lower 48, where they get no chance to even meet a candidate face-to-face.
Last thought? On around the table, single-issue politics?
Well, that's a tough one, but I personally think that single-issue politics are detrimental to our democratic process, and I think it's detrimental to good government. And the reason for that is, and I recognize that a lot of single-issue politics get into a religious orientation, and I have my beliefs, as does anyone else. But I would find it difficult to vote against a man on a single issue if he was with me at 95% of the time philosophically otherwise. I think we have the opportunity there to just absolutely destroy some fine candidates and some fine legislators who in 90 or 95% of the parameters that we're looking at are absolutely excellent, but on that one issue you would punish them and defeat them. And I think it's very destructive of both our democratic process and our government, and I think it bodes ill for the country and for the local areas, too, if we get down to that point.
Chuck Lowry speaking. I want to move again, if I may. We've got an election coming up. It's both national and local. Both the U.S. House of Representatives seat, Don Young's, is open, and Senator Ted Stevens is open. Can I just ask a bold question? Are you satisfied with our representation in Washington? At this point, it is long-term. These gentlemen have served a long time. Or would you prefer to see a change? And if you'd prefer to see a change, who? Is there a who? Nancy, I'm looking at you.
No, there is no who. I'm not, I don't think you're ever completely satisfied with someone. I get really angry sometimes. But you have to look at who else is running and then make a choice. And I suppose many people would call it, what is the least worst? I'm not saying that that's the way I look at it. I'm just saying that I have heard that term used.
One might. Any other thoughts about our representation in Washington? If it were changed, how could it be changed? And not necessarily looking at an individual at this point. What would you want more out of our representation in Washington if you're dissatisfied? I don't approach you as if it is, Bert. You are, but I throw it to you.
I'm not dissatisfied with either of the incumbents as far as their overall philosophy is concerned and their record. I have some difficulty with some issues, but there again, you've got to look at the total situation. My big problem is, once again, the structure that I feel should be changed not only in Washington but in Alaska too, and that is the consecutive seniority length of time that does not have a maximum limitation on service. I think that
restrict terms
that puts us into a situation. Yeah, right. That puts us into a situation which creates inflexibility for the electorate.
Chuck Lowry, you're nodding. Is that sufficient?
No, I would agree with that. I think that at some point, elected officials forget where they came from, and they become a part of the institution that they've been elected to so many times that all of a sudden they are detached from the people. And when they come back and speak or talk to us, this is the ritual that they must go through every so many years in order to be elected. And, you know, it's like the king, I deign to come down and sprinkle a little sand out here for you. But I think they become so engrossed in that that they're overwhelmed by their own sense of self-importance and have more loyalty to the institution than they do to those of us who are the poor folks back home.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've got elections here at home, so to speak, also. Governor and Lieutenant Governor are both opening up, of course. Jack Coghill has thrown his hat in the ring for Lieutenant Governor. Arla Sturdzielewski, Rick Halford from the Republican Party for the governor's seat. What do you think the major issues are to be considered by the electorate in electing a governor? Nancy?
Well, I think the permanent fund is... Whether to raid or not to raid is coming out to be a very important issue. Another issue is the budget. The budget is now very high. Our oil revenue is declining. Makes no difference. And the amount of oil is declining, too. Just keep spending and spending. The number of employees, state employees, has grown over the past 4 years. At some point, this has got to stop. It has come to the point now where I believe public employees are becoming extremely arrogant in their when they view the other citizens in the private sector and so on. And I have even heard people on the radio and so on say, well, look, it's important that we keep up the salaries of public employees because then people in business will have some people around who can spend money. Now, I think that's real arrogance, and I've heard that more than once.
So your thinking is to reduce spending, trim the
Absolutely.
Number of public employees.
And it's got to be done responsibly.
Okay.
If it isn't done responsibly, and now it's going to take a absolute meat axe approach, which will not be good for public employees nor for the state.
Okay. Issues on which we should elect a governor? Chuck Lowry, you have an interest in that question?
Well, yes, and I think Nancy had part of it there, but if the government doesn't have enough money to run on, then you're going to have to take some sort of action, which is taxes and so forth. But I think we have a great irresponsibility on the part of the legislature when we increased our budget this time, as I recall, to about $2.9 billion. And there's just no way you can continue to do that. I remember when Senator Bennett was still alive, he used to say there's plenty of oil out there and it would run us for a long, long time. But the problem is we're tied up with environmental concerns. We're tied up in litigation. And we even in our government, again, I'll quote Senator Coghill, who talked about we have agencies down there suing other agencies. It's like we had here in the school district and a borough suing each other. I think one of the worst problems we have is our crisis and confidence in our government, the feeling that they can get down there and do a job, do it adequately, and set aside those protection of turf issues, I guess, is the best way to call it. We're getting overrun with lawyers now down there, and the only thing we're doing is supporting lawyers as opposed to passing legislation for the benefit of the populace as a whole.
You know, I wanted to turn the discussion in this direction anyway. If we take a look at very local politics, which is to say city council and borough assembly, that's at least where you see the fires burning, there is a clear and readable crisis in trust. The last group of assembly members were elected on a wave, it seemed, of distrust of government. Cut the government out. Special interest groups are predominating in the government. We can't trust our elected officials. We must clean house. I wonder if you see this as a good sign, a bad sign, or a clear or muddled sign, I suppose. Are the voters seeing clearly here or in terms of the legislature?
Well, I think the voters are seeing clear, and I think it's a bad sign. If you quoted some statistics on elections, and Congress discussed the possibility of mail-in voting. Each year, the percentage of people voting has went down in national elections. Not that they aren't high. They're always higher in years when we have a president to be elected to. But the general trend has been a drop in the number of people who are participating in government. And it's the same thing that you hear here. Why should I? It doesn't do any good. And furthermore, when you have politicians who are elected to office and then go down there and say, all bets are off, you know, what kind of confidence does this put in anybody? You know what you're doing when you run. And we have politicians here locally who said they would not support a sales tax and get into office, and they're the first ones to introduce the sales tax. So, good or bad, you know, like Bert and I can disagree upon something, as I say here, but if I respect him as an honest man doing what he really believes is right, we can disagree on that, and I'll still participate because there's a possibility that I can change his mind.
So there is dishonesty. There is manipulation.
Well, that's obvious.
Goes
sure.
without saying.
I'll relate that back to one instance when I was chairman. I had a Democratic politician who talked to me about the borough assembly, and there were three positions of them. And his statement was, you know, you take one, I'll take one, and we'll contest the other. But we're under, you know, on the side why we will not go out and actively oppose the one that you take and the one that I take. But we'll contest the third one in there.
Now, in a different way, the Republican and Democratic parties have not been traditionally involved in very local politics in Fairbanks or in Alaska at large, actually, as far as I know. Do you think strengthened parties could clear house a bit, or do you think that the parties come with the same problems?
I'm afraid I didn't follow that one, Susan.
You were saying that there is reason to distrust government, both on a local level and a statewide level, and I'm asking you if stronger parties could be part of the solution, or if you think parties would just continue to be part of the problem, as they have been everywhere else. Parties are part of the problem.
Well, I think it could be part of the solution. Of course, they can go either way, but they can be part of the solution if they're strong enough to be held accountable as a party. And when you can clearly say, look, you're responsible for this legislation, you're responsible for these taxes or this lack of taxing or whatever the situation may be, and therefore, if there is a viable alternative in the next election, whether it be a Democrat or whatever, and that's usually your alternative, the other party, that's the way we're going to vote. And I would have no problem with that.
Anybody else want to comment on this general train of thought?
Well, I'd just like to comment that we have gotten away from the idea of citizen legislation. Certainly at the national level, that's true. I think that there was less turnover in our Congress at the last election than there was in the Russian, whatever it's called.
Politburo?
Yes. That I read several times. You take people in the state, the legislators in the state government, our city council, our borough assembly people, are all on state retirement. They're all they all receive medical benefits. It's no longer just public. It's no longer public service, as I see it. It's a lot of benefits you receive. So pretty soon, the point is to stay in. It's not to do to get in there and do what you think is right, and then put in a certain amount of time and then get out. It becomes your means of livelihood. And on the national level, that's maybe one thing. But certainly at the state level and the local level, the benefits should not be what drives a candidate. We ought to have pure public service. And I think that things would improve.
Jay Hammond proposed absolutely limited terms. I mean, since he's been out of office, he says, I forget exactly what it is, whether it's 4 years or... Anyway, he says, leave him in for X period of time and let him out again. Mm-hmm. Bert, what are your thoughts on this issue? Bert Sharp.
I think it's 8 years that was being talked about.
As his upper limit? Or
right. Yeah. There was legislation on the table this last year to limit terms to 8 consecutive years before a legislator would then be forced into taking a break and get back into what I call a real world and reestablish contacts on how to survive out there. I believe that this we have to get to that sooner or later. Citizen legislators is the key for responsible government in my mind. They, particularly the ones that have a blend of experience that is in a business or an organization that has to generate enough revenues to stay alive. That in itself would bring to state government a sense of reality on how to balance budgets and to be responsible for adding new programs and so forth to weigh the benefit to the cost ratios. I really feel that this is something that we've got to address, is the limitation on terms. It didn't get anywhere this time. It just got to be hammered at, and hopefully the seed will germinate and it'll become law. The one thing that we are blessed with in the state, though, is seniority doesn't count for a hill of beans as far as organization of the Senate or the House. That saves us a lot of grief. A committee chairman can be a freshman and has been in many instances as the party control changes in either group down there. So that's a blessing, and hopefully we can get a limitation on terms.
I want to thank you all very much. The last speaker you heard was Representative Bert Sharp. Chuck Lowry has been with us, a Republican activist. Nancy Mendenhall, also a Republican activist in this city and in this state. We've been talking today about the Grand Old Party and its perspective on party politics in Alaska. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you will join me next week when I sit down to talk to Democrats from Fairbanks about Democratic politics in the state of Alaska. We're taking a look at politics as we go around this March. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Sunday at Noon. I hope you all have a good Sunday.